Bishop FM.
Well, you're listening back to the History of Bishop Auckland Show. It's Tuesday evening here with Alex Tye. And this week we're talking to Gerald Slack, who of course has wrote a book that you might have seen, which of course is The First 5 Miles. Good evening, Gerald.
Good evening, Alex. How are you?
I'm very, very fine. How are you?
I'm feeling well and very happy to be here tonight, actually. Looking very much forward to talking about the history of the Stop and Dart Railway and the book itself.
Fantastic. Well, I'll hand over to you then if you're excited.
Well,
What's your book about, first of all?
Yeah, hi, good evening everybody. Yeah, my name's Gerald Slack. I'm very much a child of South West Durham myself, and have long had a history, a keen history in the history of South West Durham. As most people may be aware, certainly most people will be aware, the last year was in fact the 190th year anniversary of the Stop and Darton Railway, which first went live in 1825. I thought it was a very good opportunity to actually write a history of the Stockton and Darton Railway, bring people up to date in that respect, but with a real concentration on the local interest. The book itself is actually titled The First 5 Miles and deals specifically with the first 5 miles of that railway from Witton Park down as far as the Mason's Arms crossing at Shildon, which certainly in my mind is probably the most interesting section of the whole line. It's certainly on that section of the line the true railway engineering challenges were to exist. I mean, on that section we've got the Gornless Bridge at St Helens, which is the world's first cast iron railway bridge. We had the static engine houses at Etherley and at Brusselton, and many other structures along that section that probably are not replicated once you get the other side of Shildon. So the book itself is actually in two distinct parts. In the first part of the book, I've concentrated very much on the history of the Stockton Darton Railway itself, but with a real emphasis on that first five miles of the line. From 1825 onwards, the line in fact did operate on that first 5 miles up to about 1856, at which time it became redundant, but I'll come to that a little bit more at the moment. The start of the line itself is at a place called Phoenix Pit, which is not too far distant from Witton Park, just over in the fields from that. And it was at Phoenix Pit that the first wagons of coal came out in 1825 on the 27th of September, and were ultimately find their way to Stockton. The line itself then runs towards Etherley Incline, or towards what people might know as Phoenix Row today, and then climbs the Etherley Incline to Etherley Top. Before falling, and it falls all the way down as far as St Helens. At Etherley Top itself, there was, of course, a static engine house. Etherley Top is some 580 feet above sea level, and the only means of getting the coal up the incline was to actually draw it up by a static engine, so it was effectively pulled up on ropes and gravitated down as far as St Helens. The line itself then crosses the Gornless Bridge at St Helens, which was in fact the world's first cast iron railway bridge, designed by George Stephenson about 1822-23. Little is left of it there today, principally just the abutment foundations. The railway structure itself, the actual steel structure, was taken down to the National Railway Museum at York, where it still stands today, although I have to say in not a particularly good state. The line was then to climb up to the hamlet of Brusselton, again with a static engine house at the summit of Brusselton incline. Again, it's quite steep. Brusselton itself, again, stands almost 500 feet above sea level. So the line was drawn up and in fact hauled down the other side as far as the Mason's Arms crossing at Shildon. From the Mason's Arms crossing at Shildon, the line is in fact much flatter, and is relatively a coastal plain all the way out to the sea at Stockton. So it's very much in these first 5 miles that the challenges, in fact, for the railway engineering laid. I think the thing that people forget as well about the Stockton Darton Railway, it's very much about the coal that was within the Auckland coalfield that was the reason for the railway starting. Without the coal in the Auckland coalfield, there would have been no Stockton Darton Railway whatsoever. It would have not happened. The Auckland coalfield has been mined probably back to the 13th or 14th century, but the real difficulty was always getting the coal out to the markets in Durham, getting the coal out to the sea. And before the railways, it was very much a system of pack horses carrying coal, pulling it out locally, which was far from efficient. And that challenge of actually getting the coal out of the Auckland coalfield really was to stay with people for a long time. There were canal schemes that were actually considered that date back to the 1700s, and many other systems that were thought to be in place, but successfully not really, none of them actually came to success. Why Stockton Darton Railway was in fact the first railway is always a matter of debate. I think it's a combination of a number of events, really. One, the coal fields that I've already made reference to. Secondly, that we had the development of steam locomotion very much taking place in the northeast of England, with a real focus on George Stephenson and the work he was doing up at Killingworth. And thirdly, we have had at Stockton and in Darlington men who were willing to invest in the railway. It was very much a commercial venture, and had they not been able to raise the funds, the railway would have not happened. There was no question there was a real economic case to get the coal out to the sea at Stockton. Stockton itself actually placed quite a lot of challenges. The big issue with Stockton was the navigability of the River Tees at Stockton, which had always proved to be a problem. And frankly, Stockton itself did not stay as the main port on the Stockton-Darton Railway for too long. Within a matter of years, the Middlesbrough extension was built out to the River Tees at Middlesbrough, which became a far better outlet for the coal. But one will always remember the term Stockton and Darlington Railway. The other thing in writing the book, I also was very keen to actually try and put a bit of emphasis on certain aspects of history that had sort of fallen out. I mean, there's no question that the Witton Park connection was very important. And a gentleman called Bill Chater, or William Chater, who later became Sir William Chater, played a major role in the Stockton and Darton Railway. It was very much on his land, the coal on his land, that was the reason that the line actually started at Witton Park. And his involvement with the Stockton and Darton Railway was very significant. If you were to, in fact, read many of the books on the Stockton and Darton Railway, you will, in fact, find little or no mention of Mr. Chater and the Witton Park link. So there was a real attempt to try and put history into some sort of context and to actually not rewrite what in fact happened, but probably just actually put an emphasis on events that seemed to have escaped history up to that time. The second part of the book, which I will dwell on once we actually have probably had some music, is very much a walking guide, along with a gentleman called Michael O'Neill, who is the chairman of the Auckland's Railways Group. We also thought it was very important that one should in fact have a detailed guide of the route that in fact still exists today, with a real emphasis on the historical remains which are left. And it's surprising just how much there is in fact left on that first 5 miles of the line. I have in fact got a little secret I can share with you now. The distance from Witton Park Colliery or Phoenix Pit is not technically 5 miles, it's actually 5.8 miles. But in putting the title together for the book, I was acutely aware that the first 5.8 miles did not scan particularly well. No. So I used a bit of poetic license and called the book The First 5 Miles. Yeah. So we did, in fact, during the summer of 2015, spend an awful lot of time, which was in fact a real pleasure, actually walking the line and doing a fairly detailed industrial archaeological survey of that which remained. And the second part of the book is in fact the details of that survey that I'll go into shortly. The location of Phoenix Pit itself, which is in the fields near Witton Park, was always quite a challenge because we had to do quite a lot of research into old maps, old colliery maps, old ordnance survey maps to actually find Phoenix Pit itself, which was the terminus of the line. And there was quite a lot of challenges along the way in fact doing that level of research that we needed to do that. But Phoenix Pit was located, and we've plotted the route from there onwards. The other thing that the book does, of course, is try very hard to give some sort of emphasis as to the economic and social impact of the first 5.8 miles of the line. So there are quite distinct features in the book among hamlets and areas of industrial interest along the way. For instance, there's quite a detailed piece on Witton Park. Some people may know, some people may not know, that the steelworks at Witton Park, which were operate from about 1846 to about 1880, were in fact very significant. Bucklow and Vaughan, who were one of the major steel manufacturers and in fact very much instrumental in the steelworks at Middlesbrough, did in fact have an ironworks at Witton Park. And the Witton Park Ironworks, when they installed the blast furnaces there back in the 1870s, blast furnaces numbers 5 and number 6 were in fact the largest blast furnaces in the UK operating at that time. And the steel output, of course, was very significant. The iron output was very significant. The works itself were actually located right next to the River Weir on a site called Paradise. If you were to go down to Witton Park today and actually park your car at Paradise, you would actually see remarkably little evidence of what was a major industrial site that existed back in those days of the 1800s. Like many places, it sort of disappeared, really. And Witton Park itself, as a result of the decline of the steelworks, was in fact to go into decline, and the history of Witton Park and how it survived that decline with its subsequent categorisation as a Category D village is quite a story in its own right. So I've certainly started, the book certainly contains a detailed section on the likes of Witton Park. Moving farther along, I've also done a fairly detailed section on a place called Phoenix Row, which was another area that was actually built on the 1825 line back in the 1840s, which again has quite a history and very much talks about really the fate of a lot of mining-related communities in southwest Durham after the decline of the mines and this Category D notice. But like Phoenix Park, like Witton Park, Phoenix Row was also able to survive that real difficult time and still stands there today as tribute, really, to the mine that goes on. From Phoenix Row, the line itself ascends up to Etherley Top. Etherley Top is very interesting in the sense that it was the site of one of the static steam engines at the top. If you walk up the line to this day, you will in fact find little or no evidence that was ever in fact a static steam engine at Etherley Top. Unfortunately, the engine house and the engine man's cottage were demolished back in the early 80s. I think almost really a feat of industrial vandalism at the time, really, because bearing in mind their significance and their sort of railway heritage factor. But all that remains at Etherley's Top today is the evidence of one of the two reservoirs which was there. So we've done a feature on Etherley Top. Very interesting on the way, as you actually march up from Phoenix Row towards Etherley Top, you will find in situ quite a few 1825 two-hole Stockton and Darton sleepers, which are actually probably the only section that I'm aware of in the world now where there's sort of a long exposed section of sleepers on that line. So the place has real historical interest as you walk to Etherley Top.
Very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, I'm more than happy to keep going. I mean, Etherley Top itself, you will actually then fall down to a little village of Greenfields and can actually follow a path all the way down. You're then actually faced with a bit of a challenge as you get to the village of Greenfields itself as to how keen you are to follow the 1825 line there afterwards. The line itself crossed the road there under a road bridge, which is no longer there today, and enters a fairly dense bit of vegetation in the woods, which can be walked, but I suggest with some care. As you, in fact, walk down that section of the line, in fact, it does, in fact, have a pond upon it. The line enters into Cutting, and part of the 1825 line now has actually got a pond on it. The 1825 line, in fact, has its own population of mallard ducks, believe it or not. So the keen walker, having gone that route, will unfortunately have to take a bit of a diversion as he heads down through. There's a fairly well-established path through the woods above the line, which actually takes him down to what is probably now the Northbridge Park housing estate, where the line, in fact, came down the Northbridge site before it actually hit the road at St Helens. There is a fairly detailed section on that Northbridge site as well, because rather surprisingly, there was a real railway hub at that area of the line. I mean, not only did you have the 1825 line crossing the road at that point, you also had the intersection of the Hagerlees branch. The Hagerlees branch was one of the early branch railways of the Stockton and Darton line, which followed the River Gornless out basically up towards Buttonhall and actually took coal out from the collieries up towards Copley and Buttonhall and in that area. and in fact opened about 1830. So you've got the Hagelige branch coming in at that point. You've always also got the Gornus Bridge. You also start to see evidence at that point of later railway history kicking in. Auckland Colliery is in fact sited just off Northbridge Park. In fact, little or no evidence of Auckland Colliery is left, but Auckland Colliery was one of the collieries that actually built very much on the 1825 line to obviously give access to the route. And a number of other collieries sprung up in the area, feeding very much into that area. St Helens Colliery, Woodhouse Close Colliery. The actual Etherley branch itself, the branch down the line from Etherley, was to actually cease to exist in about 1842, 1843, because the Shildon Tunnel was in fact constructed, and one in fact had the Weardale Railway that went up to Witton Park and beyond Witton Park and accessed the valley up there to get the limestone reserves out. So the Etherley incline itself was actually in fact rendered redundant in 1842. Although the Brusselton incline continued some years after that. Notwithstanding that, we had the formation of this railway hub in that area. We had a station at West Auckland, of which there is little evidence there now, other than the West Auckland Station Man's Engine House, which is in fact still stands today. A gentleman called Austin Spooner, in fact, lives in that engine house as we speak. You also see the tunnel branch spanning out from there, which to it was in fact to spell the death knell of the Brusselton incline itself. One of the difficulties was as the volume of coal was feeding into the Stockton Darton line, even the Brusselton incline itself became somewhat a bottleneck on the line. It was very difficult to get the volumes of coal over the top, and no matter how efficient the Brusselton incline, the Brusselton engine house was, and certainly Timothy Hackworth had done significant engineering alterations at Brusselton from the original Stevenson insulation, it was proving a bottleneck. So the tunnel branch was actually built from just short of the Gornus Bridge, which runs out to Shildon Tunnel itself, which was in fact to prove the death knell of the Brusselton incline itself in about 1856. Notwithstanding that, the line did in fact struggle on up to Brusselton until a few years after that, mainly feeding local collieries. As to Brusselton itself, again, the book features a fairly detailed section on the hamlet of Brusselton, for those of you who've never been there. It probably might be surprising to know that at its peak, there's probably 300 to 400 people actually lived at Brusselton. It was a fairly sizeable hamlet in its own right, although little remains today of what was actually there. There was a row of houses at Brusselton called North Terrace, where there were some 42 houses, housing probably 300 people, because back in the early 1900s, it was in no way unusual for 6 or 7 people, 8 people to live in the houses up there. I mean, the people were employed locally on the collieries, and at children's shops, etc., etc. So the book, in fact, features quite a section on Brusselton itself, a village which today is no more than a scattering of few cottages, really, but very, very significantly actually has the Brusselton Engine House, which is the world's oldest static engine house. There is nothing older than the Brusselton Engine House. The next one, I think, dates from 1827. Also on the line up there, for those who should visit IC, you'll actually see that the Brusselton Incline Group have done some tremendous work in actually exposing quite a long length of the original Stockton and Darton sleepers, which actually run down the incline towards the accommodation bridges at Brusselton. And I don't think there's a length of Stockton and Darton railway sleepers longer or in better condition than the ones which are exposed at Brusselton. They have, in fact, had quite a lot of local press. There's also still in remains there one of the original accommodation bridges on the line, but unfortunately the bridge itself was subject to vandalism in 2013. Mindless vandalism, I'd probably have to say, but with significant damage to the bridge parapets and one of the supporting walls. Hopefully, in the not too distant future, we should actually see some remedial works taking place to Brusselton, because that bridge is of really great significance. There was in fact a second bridge at Brusselton on the road up to Royal Oak, a road bridge, but the road bridge was in fact demolished back in the 1960s, and there's very little evidence of the road bridge, but the accommodation bridge still stands. And beyond the accommodation bridge, again, there is still some evidence of some original Stockton Darlton sleepers.
Amazing, isn't it? What still stands, yeah.
It's amazing what still stands, and it's very interesting, Alex, that in general, and we'll obviously touch on it in a bit more detail in the future, that probably of the sort of historic remains on the whole of the Stockton and Darlton railway line, the industrial heritage which is left, probably 80-90% of it's on that first 5 miles, that first 6 miles of the route.
Good,
once you get beyond that point, there is some evidence in one or two places, but it certainly dwindles very quickly.
Yeah, well, we'll hear from a little bit more in a bit.
This is Bishop FM.
You're here on 105.9 Bishop FM, History of Bishop Auckland Show, where this week we're talking to Gerald about his new book on the Stockton Darlton Railway. Hello, Gerald, and welcome back.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for being back. Yeah, I'm very conscious, folks, that when we stopped at Brusselton, which is a little visited place now, but as I was saying at the time, was a place of real historic significance. The 1825 line from Brusselton basically went down to the Mason's Arms crossings, but very significantly actually passed through the site of Shildon Wagon Works. The wagon works at Shildon, or railway works at Shildon, started in 1825 and were in fact the first real railway engineering works in the world, and don't let anybody else tell you that. Shildon's history goes back to then. And there's little question in my mind either that New Shildon was probably the first railway town in the world. New Shildon as such would not have existed without the coming of the railways. It was very much the railways, the railway engineering that was to start there, that actually was the formation of New Shildon, which if anybody looks at an old map will see is very much a different place from Shildon itself. Yeah. Shildon Wagon Works, which features in the book, again I do a feature piece on Shildon Wagon Works, is a tremendous story really. I mean, we are talking about a place in the southwest of Durham that was to have international importance. Initially, it wasn't about building wagons at Shildon, it was about railway engineering. And before the Darlton shops were opened in 1860, Shildon was in fact a general engineering place, not only for the Stockton and Darlton Railway, but also, very famously, we had the Soho Works itself, which were a private venture run by Timothy Hackworth just down the line from Shildon Wagon Works. So very much the history of early railways and early railway engineering is at Shildon, and some of the trains that were built there, particularly the Royal George by Hackworth at the Soho Works, was in fact some of the great railways of the time.
Yeah.
I also had very much a personal interest in fact telling the story of Shildon Wagon Works within the book, because my family on my mother's side, in fact I've managed to trace back to somewhere about 1860, 1870, actually worked at Shildon Wagon Works.
Wow. Yeah.
My grandfather was in fact a millwright at Shildon Wagon Works, and his father was at Shildon Wagon Works before him, and his father was at Shildon Wagon Works before him. So on a personal level, I've got a real vested interest in actually promoting the history of Shildon Wagon Works.
Yeah.
It was to come to a very acrimonious end in 1984 when the government of the day, I'll try and avoid the Mrs. Thatcher phrase, actually closed it down, although my understanding was it was still profitable at the time. As you walk through that industrial estate today, while some of the earlier buildings are still around, it's surprising how little evidence and how little note there is of the fact that was one of the largest wagon works in the world, in fact, existed on that site.
Yeah.
I got to the Mason's Arms crossing, which was technically the point at which I should have stopped, because at that point, famously, steam would have started on the 27th of September 1825. The wagons would have been lowered down to a point near the Mason's Arms crossing, and locomotion number one, which was to become an iconic steam engine and its fresh paint in a fresh coat of paint, was in fact waiting on the day to pull the wagons and many people on its way to Stockton. But no, I thought I'd keep going because the railway interest goes on. So the book does continue the walk a little farther, running past the coal drops and down to the National Railway Museum at Shildon, and down to Hillyards Bridge, which is an 1825 bridge just beyond the National Railway Museum, which I thought was actually a good place to stop. There is in Durham County Council have actually put in a very good cycle stroke walking path now from the wagon, from the Shildon Railway Museum down as far as Aycliffe Station,
yes,
which is well worth a walk and pretty much follows the line of the 1825 line. So that really, very quickly, before we go into the wider history of Stockland Art Railway, covers the walk, the walk section of the book. I'm very keen, and I know a lot of other people are keen, that we keep walking these historic railways, because there's a great deal to see, and probably far more to see in that first 5 or 6 miles than you may imagine.
Yes.
Unfortunately, some of the structures themselves are increasingly fragile, as they would be almost 200 years on, and there is a real focus needs to be put in terms of actually maintaining some of the things which are actually left on the line, because tragically, if some effort is not put into some of the accommodation bridge structures and probably what remains of the Gornless Bridge abutments at St Helens, I do fear as to what will be left come 2025,
yes,
when we have the 200-year celebration of the Stockland-Darton Railway.
Yes.
Time is marching on now, and some of these remains do need some real effort to keep them going. But I think the more people who are aware of their historical significance, the more people who walk the line, the impetus will be there. Some of you may know the Friends of the Stockland-Darton Railway are in fact pursuing a World Heritage status for the 1825 line all the way from Stockton up as far as Witton Park, and we've got to wish them well in those efforts, because there's no question that the early railways in southwest Durham and the 1825 line would have a profound effect on the world. I mean, some railway historians would in fact probably say the opening of the Stockland-Darton line on the 27th of 1825 was probably a more important date in world history than the 4th of July 1960, whatever it was, when the first men walked on the moon.
Yeah.
In many ways, the modern world started with the coming of the railways, and the railways were to change everything.
Mm.
And the first commercial railway was the Stockland-Darton line.
Yes.
And very quickly, because the Stockland-Darton line was perceived to be a success, it was perceived to be running economically, making money, it gave confidence to a lot of other people to, in fact, move on with their own railway schemes. The Liverpool and Manchester line opened in 1830, very much driven by the confidence from the Stockland-Darton line. And the railway network in the UK, in fact, went at a tremendous pace, so a lot of the major lines were in fact laid in the UK by 1850, only 27 years after the opening of the Stockland-Darton line. But if you actually look at the Stockland-Darton line, a lot of the railway protocol that in fact came about from Stockland-Darton has actually existed to this day. The standard gauge, 4'8½", in fact, derives itself from the Stockland-Darton line. The truth of the matter is the Stockland-Darton line was actually constructed to 4'8".
Right.
Not 4'8½". And the best evidence I've ever had for the extra half inch was probably that once other railway companies got involved with slightly wider flanges on their trains, they in fact pushed it out to 4'8½". But the standard gauge, in fact, of 4'8" started here on the Stockland-Darton line. And in fact derived, I believe, from some of the early wagonways, the Killingworth wagonway, way in the northeast of England.
Hmm.
And that really was the gauge for the railways throughout the world.
Yeah.
And much of the railway protocol that existed on the Stockland-Darton line, a lot of the early practices around their passenger service, etc., were to actually persist going forward.
Hmm.
The first passenger railway station was at Darlington at North Road. Not in the location it's at today, but not too far from the location it's at today. The railways were also to bring railway time. Standardisation of time was very much a feature of those early railways. People, in fact, would live in communities that had quite different time frames. The sun, the rising and setting of the sun would govern local time, and it was very much the coming of the railways that would, in fact, give this rigour, this regularity at the time.
Yeah.
A lot of these things, in fact, started with the Stockland-Darton Railway itself. If you look at some of the very early Stockland-Darton timetables, they will, in fact, refer to the fact that the time on the railway is governed by the GPO clocks in London, and the clock at Darlington, on the High Road, Darlington, at one of the watchmakers, or at Stockton High Street, was, in fact, the time of the day.
Yeah.
So very much a strong influence in terms of what the Stockton Darton Railways actually brought to it.
It does.
As to the book itself, we launched it at Witten Park itself. Very fortunate to have Lord Foster, who right. actually conducted the launch on the day. Very successful event in which, working with the Auckland Railways Group, of which I'm a member, we had quite a lot of other people who participated in the event. And the event was not just about launching this book. It was very much about the celebration of the railway heritage of the North East. Yeah. We had the Shildon Model Railway Club there. We had some young boys from the Stockton and Darton youth team. We had the Weardale Railways Group. We had the Stevenson Society, who in fact brought down a working steam model
Fantastic.
Of locomotion number one, which, trust me, attracted a tremendous amount of attention on the day.
Yeah.
And it was very much a celebration of the area and a celebration of Witten Park itself.
Yeah.
Because, as you may remember, I touched on earlier, that there's a real sort of history in that area of the world.
It is.
The book itself is out there. Please go out and buy a copy. It's very much an economic and social history. It's very much a local history. Copies are available of the book in quite a few locations at the National Railway Museum at Shildon. At Bishop Station, Bishop Trains have got copies in there. Bishop Press have got copies in there. Their offices at the Town Council offices in Shildon. It's $8.99. I deliberately kept the price at a sensible price. I wanted people to buy it, and I wanted people to actually read about their local railway history.
Yeah,
you know, and I haven't stopped there. I'm still working on producing more material. I'm working with Michael O'Neill, the chairman of the group, actually pushing hard, pumping out more material to try and just get people in this area to be very much aware of the significance, not just of the Stockton and Darton line and its heritage locally, but also the sort of Auckland railway heritage in its wider sense.
Yeah.
There's a tremendous amount of local railway history in southwest Durham, in the Auckland's area. Mm. And it's very much a focus on actually, you know, informing people of the history that exists locally in terms of the railways, not just on the Stockton and Darton line, but in Bishop Auckland and surrounding areas.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. It's absolutely incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Aye. Anyway, we'll be back in a few minutes' time.
Thanks, Alex.
This is Bishop FM.
Can you join me, Alex, and Gerald on the History Show this evening? We've been talking to Gerald for the last 45 minutes, well, 50 minutes now. Hello there, Gerald.
Hi again, Alex. Really, I mean, no more to say. The main thing is to say thanks, and thanks for the time this evening for actually talking about a subject which I suggest most people can probably gather is fairly passionate. I'm fairly passionate yes. about. I mean, I think Southwest Durham, which is very much the area of my birth, you know, is a very, very significant place. And frankly, I think every opportunity should be taken to actually promote what actually happened here.
I agree.
There's no question that the birthplace of the railways occurred in Southwest Durham, really. I mean, the coal reserves in Southwest Durham started the Stockton and Darton Railway, and things snowballed after the event. I mean, as I've said earlier, from the Stockton and Darton Railway, the world became a very different place.
Yes.
You know, the confidence is out there amongst other people to adopt railways, and all of a sudden we saw the railway network spiralling the country, you know, meeting the demands of the Industrial Revolution actually changing the way people lived. I mean, the railways, in fact, had an amazing effect on people's psyche. They actually shrunk the relationship between distance and time.
That's it, yeah.
You know, we need to remember that before the railways, nobody had ever really travelled any faster than a galloping horse.
That's it, isn't it, yeah.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, you know, we have this system that can take the average man, because the railways were very democratic.
Mm.
You know, the richest and the poorer were travelling on the same contraption at the same speed first time.
Yeah.
Could actually move at speeds which were far in excess of that of a galloping horse, and actually access areas they couldn't access before.
Hmm.
People became far more interested in working in other areas, far more able to travel about.
That's it, yeah.
But let's keep saying it. It pretty much started here. You know, there were colliery tramways out there, but the first true commercial railway started was the Stockton and Darton Railway, and the reason for the Stockton and Darton Railway were the coal reserves in Southwest Durham.
Yeah.
And that first 5 or 6 miles of that line is a very significant piece of 5 to 6 miles. The engineering challenges that were to exist on that line and were overcome by George Stephenson and Timothy Hackworth and others,
yes,
were actually profound achievements in their day, and in many ways represented doing it for the first time.
Yeah.
Some of the things that they achieved had not been done before.
That's it.
So it's a very significant event.
It is, anyway.
Right.
Yes, thank you for coming on my show. But, yes, as Gerald said all the way through, the fact that Stockton Downton Railway did start around here, and of course, well, as you said before, it's all the way across the world now, isn't it?
Absolutely.
If we hadn't had the Stockton Downton Railway, we would be nowhere, really.
Well, one probably has to agree that a railway would have started somewhere.
Well, yes.
But the reality of the situation, this is what really matters, is it started here.
It did.
Yeah.
Right underneath our noses, really.
Literally. Not too far from where you and I are sitting.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, we're sat in the South Church, aren't we, so...
Not far.
Not far at all.
Not far at all.
Yes. Absolutely incredible, really, isn't it? But yes, anyway, thank you for coming on my show today.
No, it's been a delight, and thank you for inviting me.
Yes. But yes, to all you listeners... that was Gerald, and you can buy his book in, well, you can buy it in any shop, really. Well, Bishop Trains.
Bishop Trains is a good venue, National Railway Museum at Shildon. As I say, Bishop Press have actually got some as well. It's out there, and I highly recommend it.
Yes, and it is very, very good for walking. I mean, I've just turned to look through, and it's got walking references in, so you can actually pick up the reference as well.
Yeah, I was very keen on the walking thing, that I'm very conscious that people do use GPSs now and do have all sorts of navigation devices, so I've moved forward with modern technology, and it's got quite a few grid references and stuff in it, so unless one tries very hard, one shouldn't be able to get lost across along the first 5 miles of that route.
Yes, that's it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is the best way to come across today.